This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ed White has chronicled gay culture for over 2 decades in his fiction and nonfiction. He knew he was gay when he was 12, but he was so guilt-struck, he spent 7 years going to psychiatrists hoping to be cured. He was at the Stonewall Bar the night of the 1969 Stonewall Uprising, which marks the beginning of the gay rights movement. That night also marked a turning point in White's life. His essays are collected in the new book, The Burning Library. They begin in 1969 and end deep in the AIDS era. White is HIV positive. Last year, White won a National Book Award for his biography of the French writer Jean Genet. It's just been published in paperback. White lives in Paris now. I spoke with him last month during his brief trip to the States and asked him to read an excerpt from his forthcoming collection of short stories called Skinned Alive. This is from a story called Watermarked about first love.
Our love worked well because Randall was the one man in 1,000 who welcomed devotion and who, like a medieval princess, believed in it only after it had been proved by many deeds and long trials. Most men like chasing after rather than being the quarry and flee someone too obviously in love. Being adored suffocates and gives them too little imaginative scope. Only someone unobtainable leaves enough room for dreams, inspires longing, promotes scheming, and implies arrival, whereas a quick and total conquest is the last act that abrogates all need for the preceding drama. But Randall had had enough strife at home and wanted to be cherished. I so enjoyed serving him and supporting him and listening to him that I forgot my own existence, certainly my own uninteresting face. If I would glance at my own reflection after a long evening spent with him, I'd be offended by the reminder that such sustained communion hadn't improved my looks. I learned what a burden beauty can be. Drunk men at parties would take an instant dislike to Randall. Eventually I figured out their reasoning. I want him. He thinks he's too good for me. The bastard. He didn't want to be liked merely for his looks, but he needed to maintain them just in case.
You know, I was thinking, reading this story about a first love, about whether, you know, when you're talking about looks and what, you know, whether men like to be the pursuer or the pursued. And I was thinking if those kinds of things are much different when the relationship is gay than it is from when it's straight. You know, I was identifying with you. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, I think that, I mean, some people say that the burden of being a gay man is that you're supposed to be as successful as a man and as beautiful as a woman. Mm. I mean, in other words, you have to play both roles, and or ideally you're expected to. And I think a lot of gay men feel under tremendous pressure to be both successful and attractive, and it's awfully hard to be either one, but certainly to be both is rare.
You know, in the beginning of this story, you write about learning to be gay, learning certain behaviors, learning to dish,
right,
and then teaching it to others. Were there aspects of gay culture that you felt you actually learned?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a difference between being homosexual and being gay. I mean, I think homosexual is simply a question of desire for a certain kind of sexual encounter with members of your own sex. But being gay implies a whole culture, a whole way of acting, of thinking, and it changes, of course, from decade to decade. In the case of this story, I talk about someone who's coming out in the late 1950s and who's learning from Chicago street queens how to camp and how to dish and how to, I mean, it's the sort of thing that I guess we know about now from drag queens, but that then in those days was more generally acceptable in gay society.
As you've gotten older, how has your idea of the ideal companion changed?
Well, I think that I now prize real intimacy more than I did before. Perhaps I didn't even know what it was. I mean, I lost my lover to AIDS this last March, and his name was Hubert. He was French. I was with him for 5 years. And I think that in my own case, I was always afraid of intimacy with people. But when you live with someone I mean, the last 4 of the 5 years that we were together, we knew that he had AIDS and didn't have long to live. And when you know, when you're living with somebody that you know is not going to live very long, you give up all your fears about guarding your independence, and you just give yourself completely to somebody, just as I feel that he gave himself to me. I mean, he had been married when I met him, and he gave up his wife, his language, his country, his job, to come with me when I was coming to Providence to teach at Brown University in 1990. And so I felt like he had made a total gift of himself to me, and that's what I wanted to be able to give to him. But I think before that, I had never really understood that kind of gift. I mean, I hear people today talk about codependency as though it's a bad thing, but I think, in fact, that's what love is. Love is codependency. It's perfectly okay to be codependent.
Did you take care of him at the end when he was sick?
Yes, I was with him in Morocco. We had been there in January, and he liked it so much because of the warm weather, and he wanted to go back, so we went back in March, even though everyone advised us against it. And he wanted to see the desert before he died. It was really a very romantic death in a way, but also very harrowing, especially for me. So we did get to Erfoud, which is in the southeastern corner of Morocco, in the Sahara, and there he began to go, and I drove feverishly to get us back to a hospital and hopefully to a plane that would take us back to Paris, and I had made all the arrangements for a medical repatriation, but in fact he died in Marrakesh before he could get back. And then I had to make all those ghastly arrangements for the repatriation of the body, which is a very complicated thing to do in a Muslim country when you're sending the body to a Christian country.
Oh, gosh, who wants to be stuck with administrative work after the person you love most in the world is gone?
Well, the funny thing is that he was he had been an architect when I met him, and then he had to quit architecture because he wasn't well enough to do it. And then he turned himself into an illustrator, and we did a book together called Sketches from Memory, which is going to come out next year. And it's his illustrations and my texts about our area in Paris, where we lived in the very heart of Paris, the Châtelet area. And it's just sort of little, very funny little glimpses, I hope they're funny, of the people, like the concierge and the Cambodian man who runs the delicatessen across the way, who also writes poetry and who's, in fact, Cambodia's most famous poet. And, so it was really just little sketches of people. And he was determined to finish this book, and he did finish it just 1 week before he died. And when he was dying in Morocco, he said to me, "I wish you would write an introduction explaining who I was and how I wrote this book." So on the plane coming back from Morocco, I mean, he died that morning, and on the very day that he died, I think I realized I really must be a writer, because it's the only thing I know to do when I'm this unhappy and afraid of really going crazy. I was afraid if I started sobbing too much, they wouldn't let me on the plane or something, and I had to get back to make the funeral arrangements. So anyway, there I was on the plane, feverishly writing away, and I finished the introduction just as we came into Paris.
Throughout your career as a writer, you've written about relationships and about being gay. And you have a new book that collects your essays from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And there's something that you wrote in a 1977 essay called The Joys of Gay Life about relationships that I'd like you to read for us.
Sure, with pleasure. One of the things we are forced to re-examine is relationships. Unlike straight people, we do not have church weddings. We are not often enrolled in the PTA. We are not clear on who is the breadwinner and who is the homemaker. We don't have relatives clucking over us, urging us to be faithful and fertile and upstanding. Our relationships have little social or legal reality. As a result, we must invent love all over again.
I'm wondering the different ways you feel you've invented love, if you feel like you've invented it and reinvented it over the years as things have changed.
Well, yes, I mean, I think so. I mean, I think that probably originally, as this story Watermarked reveals, one of my images probably for love was something like the gentleman who's in love with a dancer at the ballet or something like that. I mean, I was the guy who wasn't so great looking but who was very ardent, and the other person, the person I was in love with, tended to be somebody extraordinarily beautiful. And I've written quite a bit about physical beauty. And I know that some of my gay critics have accused me of looksism, which is supposed to be a very bad thing. But I think, of course, most artists are probably sensitive to beauty in all of its forms. But for me, I think it was part of my own inferiority complex that I, not just because I felt I was quite average looking, but also because I felt inferior as a gay man. And I needed to have this terribly flashy beauty on my arm to reassure myself that I was okay. And as a consequence, I learned a lot about what it must be like to be beautiful and to have all the problems and advantages of being extraordinarily beautiful. But I think over the years, that notion changed. I mean, maybe because I became more sure of myself, but I'm not at all indifferent to physical beauty, but it's not very high on my priority list anymore. I think what I like most now is tenderness, a reciprocal love, shared interests, and I think tenderness is really the word.
If this isn't too personal, has your idea of monogamy changed over the years, of the relative importance or unimportance of it?
I've never believed that people should try to be monogamous. I think there's something slightly dispiriting and kind of lower middle class about the idea of wanting to, I mean, sort of suburban about wanting to be faithful. I mean, with Hubert, my last lover, I was faithful even when he was too ill to have sex and we didn't have sex anymore. I was still faithful to him because it's what I wanted to be. It didn't occur to me to be any way else. I think when you feel drawn to the other person to such an extent, and you have such a trust with the other person that monogamy is inevitable, well, then I think it's perfectly okay. But as an ideal, I don't hold it up.
My guest is Ed White. He has a new collection of essays called The Burning Library. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Ed White. In your new collection of essays, The Burning Library, you write about the first time you saw one of the backroom bars of Greenwich Village in 1970, and this was shortly after you got back to the village after living in Rome for close to a year. What was your reaction when you first saw that?
I thought it was a little bit scary, but also terrific. I mean, it seemed to me that, I mean, now that because of AIDS, we all tend to act as though there was something abnormal and distressing and inevitably sinful about that period of promiscuity. And even the word promiscuity, of course, is one that is loaded against the people who practice it. But I think that, I think it was Susan Sontag once who said that there was only a very brief period for both men and women, both gays and straights, when they weren't when they were able to be sexually free. And basically, it's something that started with the sexual freedom started with the invention of antibiotics and later the birth control pill and ended with AIDS. So in other words, let's say there's a period of 15 or 20 years when in all of human history, when people had all the necessary conditions, which include the anonymity of living in a big city, the breakdown of traditional religion, the freedom from venereal disease, the freedom from becoming pregnant through sex, when people could actually practice sex as a form of self-expression, as a form of art, as a form of pleasure, rather than as a form of economic exchange or all the other things that sex has been harnessed into serving.
And you're grateful that you had a chance to experience that period.
I would say yes, and I think a lot of people who lived through that period and enjoyed it thoroughly are now betraying it by condemning it. But that's just part of the new fashionable Puritanism, which I don't approve of at all.
I want to read an excerpt from an essay you wrote in 1983 that was originally published in Vanity Fair called Sexual Culture. And you were writing, no homosexual can take his homosexuality for granted. He must sound it, palpate it. For that reason, all homosexuals are, quote, gay philosophers, and that they must invent themselves. And then you wrote, on the other hand, no straight man stands in rapt contemplation of his straightness unless he's an ass. And so I guess, you know, like so much of your life has been given over to writing about being gay, both in your essays, in your autobiographies, in your fiction.
You know, I have the strange feeling that that writing itself is somehow linked to homosexuality. And I haven't worked this out, so I won't be able to make any sense of it. But I think it's really very odd, if you think of it, that now Time magazine tells us this week that only 1.5% of people are gay. So if that's true, think how very, very few homosexuals there actually are. And yet, if you look at the famous writers of this century, I mean, a huge high proportion of them are gay. And it seems to me that there is something that about writing itself, which is a way of at once participating in society, but also looking at it from an enormous distance, of at once imitating the conventions of society while having a very jaundiced eye toward them. It seems to me that that spirit which animates the work of homosexual writers like Proust, for instance, or Gide, or Jean Genet, it seems to me that there is something fundamental. I mean, in other words, something about being gay means that you pass or can pass as an ordinary member of society, and yet you always feel different. You always feel that you're of this other race. So it's a bit, I suppose, like a black person who looks white or a Jew who doesn't look Jewish, who is passing as a Gentile or as a white person or in the case of a homosexual, as a heterosexual. In other words, you're a kind of double agent and you're living a different kind of life from the one you feel inside. And so I think when I keep talking in these essays about the need of gay people to invent themselves, it's also, I think, that they have a need for seeing through the conventions of ordinary society.
So you think part of the reason why you became a writer was the sense of being the double agent?
Definitely. I think when I first began writing, it was like a kind of a desperate attempt to fight off the waves of self-hatred and guilt that I think were really threatening my sanity. I mean, when I was 14 or 15 years old, a psychiatrist told my mother that I should be put in a mental hospital and they should just throw the key away, that I was unsalvageable. And I certainly was, I think, right on the edge of a mental collapse. And the one thing that saved me was writing. And I went to a boarding school, and I would do all my homework in the afternoon so that at night during study hall, all I would have to do for those 2 hours was work on my novel. So I had already finished a novel by the time I was 15, another one by the time I was 17. And I didn't write in a kind of arty way. I was writing out of a real desperate need to make sense of the world, to fight off this madness.
Let me just backtrack for a second here. I think I know what you mean, but why would a straight person who stands in rapt contemplation of his heterosexuality be an ass?
Well, it'd be like a white person sort of looking at his own body and saying, oh, aren't I beautiful? I'm all white. I mean, you would just say, what a nitwit, you know. Whereas a black person who says black is beautiful, you can understand that, because since the dominant society did, at least until 20 or 30 years ago, find the state of being black inferior, and little black girls back in those days used to buy white dolls. To say black is beautiful was a revolutionary statement. To say white is beautiful is idiotic.
So it's about contemplating your difference.
Yeah. I mean, in other words, I think if you're coming from a persecuted minority, you need to redefine yourself, not in the terms of the dominant society, but in your own terms, in new terms that will empower you or enfranchise you. Whereas if you are already a member of the dominant society, to simply glory in being dominant is fatuous.
In one of your essays, you write that although at some point in your career. You started writing for what you perceived as a sophisticated gay reader earlier on as a writer. You saw your audience as an older European heterosexual woman.
Yes.
Well, who was this idealized reader and why?
Well, I think it was Mrs. Nabokov. And because, and she actually would read my writing. And when I finally met her years later after her husband had died. I went to the Montreux Palace Hotel in Switzerland and met her. And she was already quite deaf. And she did that thing that deaf people oftentimes do of just doing all the talking, because that way they don't have to hear what you have to say. But I didn't mind, because she also did the thing that every writer dreams of another person doing. She recited pages of my first novel, Forgetting Elena, by heart, because she, in fact, had a photographic memory, and she could just summon up whole pages of one's prose and recite them. And to have the woman to whom Nabokov dedicated every one of his novels and the muse of the greatest writer of the century recite to you whole pages of your own work was, of course, the most delicious thrill imaginable. So, but long before that, before I ever knew her, but when I knew that, in fact, she was reading my writing because she would write me notes about it, I did have her as a kind of ideal reader, and not just because I admired her husband and her and them as a couple, but also because it seemed to me like a filter to make sure that, I mean, one of the things that I sometimes don't like about contemporary gay writing is that I feel that it makes a lot of inside references that make it accessible only to other gay people. And one of the things I wanted to try to do was to write about gay experience from the inside and in a fairly sophisticated way, without any hint of apology, and yet in a way that would be totally accessible to people who weren't gay. And I don't know, I mean, once a heterosexual man in England said to me that he never had thought he'd had a single homosexual thought in his whole life, but that he had found himself getting very excited once reading one of my sex scenes between two men, and that thrilled me, not because I had managed to excite this particular man, but who wasn't one of my dream people, but just the idea that I had been able to communicate what that kind of desire would be like to somebody who wasn't cut out for it at all.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, as I always do.
Ed White's new collection of essays is called The Burning Library. His biography of Jean Genet has just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.